Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, as you know, on this show, I like to look into the heretical science, the heretical history, and the heretical people. And many of these people who were on television in my childhood and got along perfectly well, in the new regime that we find ourselves in, have been cancelled. And one of those is Dr. David Starkey, who I'm very glad to say I shall be talking to today. David, hello.
Hello.
Why did you get cancelled?
Oh, I mean, like everybody else, I said something very slightly out of turn. It's curious. I uttered the phrase, admittedly, at the moment of the 2011, and what I mean, let me get date right, dear me, historians stuttering over dates, the 2020 BLM riots, the Black Lives Matter riots, if you remember, in the wake of an incident which had absolutely no meaning whatever for Great Britain at all. The death of George Floyd, we were thrown in turmoil in the middle of lockdown. The police, which had been rigorous, you know, people were fined for sort of breathing over each other on a park bench. Suddenly, huge processions in London, which of course were, we must emphasise this, as with the Notting Hill Carnival, they were mostly peaceful. I mean, oddly, quite a few people seemed to get injured and the odd copper got bashed around a bit. And we had peacefully to board in a Churchill statue. Yes, it was peacefully defaced or possibly peacefully toppled over, like the unfortunate statue of the greatest benefactor of Bristol, which was chucked into the harbour and so on. And I got a little bit tired of all of this. And I suspect, like you, when one gets tired, one becomes a little irritable. I got a certain sense, even in your introduction, that you were the kind of chap who occasionally sort of blows tops, you know, your voice went up and all the rest of it. Anyway, one of the things that was striking in this preposterous fusion of the American experience of the black, completely different with entrenched slavery, entrenched discrimination, with even the beginning of correction delayed effectively until the 1960s, despite emancipation after the Civil War, the complete conflation of that into Britain, the idea that the British police would ever put their foot on anybody's neck, and that they would ever, I mean, basically, I mean, the number of times they've killed anybody is almost without, very difficult actually to identify it. Nevertheless, we were told this was a profoundly important event. We had Keir Starmer going down on his knees. We had Angela Rayner accompanying him in this bizarre up and, remember, they did it in an office. They did it in an office. As
separated.
Oh, well. Of course they went, dear, dear me. And the thought of Starmer and Rayner together, really, there are some things that one could tolerate. That's not one of them. Anyway, the thing that struck me most about it was that there was something that's actually become very, very, and I'm going on a bit because it matters, something that has now become very, very apparent. There was a desire, this invocation of the vital role of slavery in the history of Britain as well as the horrors of the American experience. Because remember, America, slavery is genuinely the hereditary curse. Genuinely, genuinely. The great Dr. Johnson puts it very clearly. Here is a country founded on the protestation of freedom. And yet, it includes slavery as an essential part of its economy and politics. He has this wonderful phrase, nobody yelps more loudly in favour of liberty than a Yankee slave driver. It's a wonderful, wonderful phrase, and it pierces to the heart of that contradiction. We don't have it. We abolished slavery.
So all these tensions and annoyances and irritations have built up.
They built up really at that particular moment, because what was really going on was the idea that slavery is a genocide, that slavery is also the fundamental curse of Britain and the essential characteristic of the British Empire, the foundation of our economy, and generally speaking, the thing that subverts everything about Britain in general and England in particular. I find this an absurd assertion. the genocide of the Jews carried out by Hitler and with his attendant powers in the middle of the 20th century is an almost unique phenomenon. Except, of course, it echoes very strongly the equivalent attack on Judaism under the Emperor Titus in ancient Rome, when Jerusalem falls, the temple is stripped, the Jews are driven out of Palestine and so on, and that great eternal diaspora of a nation and a religion without a state, without a home, begins. But what there is has gone on is a deliberate attempt at by the left, first by the blacks and now by the Palestinians and the left in general, to dethrone the Holocaust. To say, remember, ever since the Second World War, the Holocaust has been our moral plimsoll line. It's been the thing that determined, in a sense, good and bad, been the great dividing line. What's now happening is a determined attempt to dethrone that, to instead invent new victims, new fashionable causes.
If we're going to go down this line, I suppose you could say the issue for the left is they tend to be antithetically, they hate power, they dislike power. This is the fundamental postmodern kind of idea.
Therefore, Israel, of course,
is power. But on the other hand, Judaism is weakness because of the Holocaust. And so then they have a very difficult relationship. How do you negotiate that line?
I don't think they have a difficult relationship at all. They've decided quite simply that the original Holocaust has been abrogated, it's been destroyed, simply because Israel has now become a new occupying colonialist power that is, of course, inflicting, it is claimed, a genocide on the Palestinians.
The same people will then use the Holocaust and Hitler and so forth to smear opponents that are on the right. And they will say, well, you're very bad because you are in some way aligned with Hitler. And
you haven't been listening very carefully to the left, have you? If you actually look at the moment, there's very little on the left that actually, as it were, takes anti-Semitism or the original Holocaust as a moral index at all. It's been completely displaced. As I said, there was first the determination, which they had to abandon. It's really interesting, Ed, what they had to do. And because there is, unfortunately, this is fascinating, and we should be discussing it now, there is actually a United Nations formal definition of genocide. And do you know what? They actually discovered that slavery didn't correspond. So you've got to invent another crime, which is called a crime against humanity. But unfortunately, it does rank a little bit lower in the pecking order. But of course, one of the things that's so striking is the use now of the term absolutely without mitigation on the left to describe what's gone on and what's going on in Palestine and the elevation of the Palestinians. You see, what we've got now is an index of victimhood. You may be familiar with my dear friend Ruth Dudley Edwards. We go 1,000 years into the 1960s. She's a great expert on Ireland and Irish republicanism, who were some of the original inventors of this concept of victimhood and terrorism and horror and all the rest of it. She came up with this wonderful phrase, MOPE, the most oppressed people ever. And there is this intense competition now to be MOPE, to be the most oppressed people ever. It looked as though it was going to be won by the blacks, and Floyd was all about that. Now, of course, it's being won by the Palestinians, which is why they're so fashionable, and which again accounts for this bizarre business of the left, which believes in everything that they don't. You have this lunatic position that parading through the streets of London, there are queers for Palestine. Now,
Allah loves gays.
Only in London. And only in the streets of London, I imagine, not actually in the houses of Allah's worshippers in this country, because I think queers for Palestine, if they found themselves in Palestine, would actually be very grateful for the final coup de grace of being thrown off a building, bearing in mind what would happen to them beforehand. Anyway, all of this is really a gigantically long preface of explaining why I lost my temper. And when I was explaining why I didn't think Even in the United States, slavery was a genocide. I mean, let's again look at the statistics. Have you any idea actually how many slaves were exported, largely it's true, by Britain to the 13 colonies? In other words, how many black slaves were there in the 13 colonies before the Declaration of Independence? Roughly? A few hundred thousand. 600,000. And you then look at this immense process of multiplication. So just because you asked me a question, I'm a great believer, even after a very long preface, that one eventually gets round to answering it. I said, you know, I described what had happened in America, however horrible the Western Passage and all the rest of it was. And then I finally said, but it can't be a genocide, can it? 600,000 multiplying to tens of millions, maybe even 100 million. I can't remember what the black percentage of the black population of the states is. And so it can't be a genocide because there wouldn't be so many damn blacks if there were. Mm. So it was simply that. In the same way, I think, let's be truthful, it would be actually not terribly surprising if somebody used that phrase in the wake of the Notting Hill Carnival. I mean, after all, we are told it's a celebration of Caribbean culture. We see, in fact, the culture is celebrated with two murders, one of whom is a woman with child stabbed in her crotch. Now, the thing that irritates me, I am absolutely the reverse of a conventional racist. What I believe is things should be talked about, frankly. And the key issue when you look at the Notting Hill Carnival is the fact, bluntly, that knife crime in London is four times more common amongst blacks than it is amongst the rest of the population. In other words, knife crime is quite disproportionate, and this is the important thing. It's black on black. But of course, black lives matter only when they're taken by whites.
This reminds me of something, which is that there's a number of studies that indicate that left-wing people and right-wing people treat blacks differently.
Of course.
And there's a tendency for left-wing people who will say, you know, there are no psychological differences, we're all the same, to change their register and to their vocabulary and to talk down to black people.
Or even to do a kind of pseudo-black. A kind of pseudo-Jamaican, is that?
Yeah, perhaps that as well. Yes, yeah, yeah. Kamala Harris does. And another thing, that the right, though, they tend to just talk to them as they would talk to anybody else. And I was in Detroit, and I was asking these black young black people about various interesting things to do with psychology and racial differences, and one of them said to me, like, no white person's ever talked to me like this before. I said, well, what do you mean?
In other words, assuming they're as intelligent.
It could be
as intelligent as you were.
I talk to my children. But I remember that you did a series, must have been 15 years ago more, where there were a series of celebrity academics and whatever, and they had to be school teachers in a rough school.
With unfortunately, a very real bad headmaster. A headmaster with the complete opposite of the Michaela School and all the rest of it, was a kind of entrenched quintessence of every absurd intellectual matter.
You notice, because I think that my research indicates that obviously intelligence has been selected for strongly, particularly since the Black Death, but even under the Warm period, where it was weakened selection, it was still selected more strongly than now, because child mortality was probably about 35%, something like that. But one thing you noted, and it particularly piqued the interest, I remember I can visualise it now, this black young man, look at the way the Vikings write. Look at what they're writing about. Look at their poetry. This is rap. This is modern day rap.
Hmm.
And this fascinated him. And I think that a lot of white pieces
would not have dared. But it seemed to me to be absolutely obvious. I mean, you look at the Vikings. They adored bling. They covered themselves in gold. This again, culture of an aggressive masculinity. The handling of women. The performative weapons, not simply the dueling and the fighting, but the deliberate drama that surrounds it. You know, again, it's Porgy and Bess does exactly that same thing with the Montagues and Capulets. It's why that works so magnificently, because it's tapping in to an earlier cultural form, which, of course, is one of the things that is dominant in that book, that I edited in front of you, which is the idea of chivalry. Except, of course, chivalry shows a very characteristically Western shift. That's to say, it glorifies, in one sense, male violence, but it's also intended in a way which, on the whole, black culture, or certainly Viking culture, wasn't, to moderate it, to socially channel it, and above all, to link it with another coupling idea that civilized relations between men and women.
But it's an earlier form, isn't it? Are you familiar with that book, Sex and Culture, by J.D. Unwin?
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that as the society becomes more developed, it becomes more repressive of sexuality. And his argument is that the result of that is that you place...
Then, dear me, we are underdeveloping.
Yeah, quickly,
aren't we underdeveloping? Yes.
The chivalrous idea is patriarchy. Man wants sex, woman wants investment. Those two things are swapped over, are exchanged. But then the man says, oh, well, I want to be able to control your sexuality if I have to invest in you. And so then you have, in chivalry, you know, the idea of the very female, patriarchally submissive woman.
Oh, carefully, carefully, carefully.
You don't get that in black.
No, indeed not. But so let me correct you. You wildly misunderstood. I mean, the whole relationship of the knight and his lady undergoes a violent transformation. Remember, the Chaucer, as always, puts it brilliantly. A man is servant in love, but lord in marriage. When a man is pursuing a woman, he is formally submissive for her. It's why you still go down on your knee.
Yes,
it's why. But the man has to really ritually submit himself to the woman, and you physically humiliate yourself. Again, something that I spent much of my life studying, that's to say, the court of Henry VIII and Henry VIII's own behaviour with Anne Boleyn. The king would have gone down on his knees.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Then the difference between the chivalrous culture of the Western world and so forth and the culture.
But I think it's really important that we see that, again, the tension between the two is a dynamic one, and it goes throughout the relationship. And again, it is, you see a transformation at the end of the relationship when a woman who is widowed acquires full legal, commercial, and landed status, you know, which is why you have Veuve Clicquot, you know, the widow Clicquot Champagne House, a woman who is not what in English law is called femme couverte, a covered woman, assumes full rights over her own property and the ability to conduct commercial transactions, landed transactions. And indeed, if you look at the wealth distribution in early Tudor England, the great bulk of the landholdings, many of the greatest families, the De Veres are an outstanding, Earls of Oxford are an outstanding example, the great bulk of the wealth holding will be held by very long-lived widows. And everybody, as you know, pays the most profound attention to these women. Power brokers.
Yeah,
we've wandered, haven't we?
We have.
isn't it rather wonderful as a conversation? Yeah,
love and things like this, and the troubadours. But as it occurs to me now, you've mentioned the Tudors a number of times. That's your area. And I have this book here, chaps, which I bought in Sutton in about 1991. And the English rather goes over my head. Rivals in Power: Lives and Letters of the Great Tudor Dynasties, edited by David Starkey. And one of the things that fascinates me about this, as I was saying before we started, was that the research that I've been doing on intelligence and so forth indicates that we reached peak of intelligence about on various proxies in about 1870, and now we are going backwards. And by the end of the century, we will be down, if we are 100 now, we will be 85 by the end of the century.
Can we just investigate why? Do you think it's a relationship to the printed text?
The theories that I have presented are that it's contraception, which militates in favour of intelligence. It's weaker Darwinian selection pressures, and it used to be that we were a society of social descent, and that every generation, those at the bottom, would die off. The child mortality of 50%, the richer 50% of people on parish records in Tudor England, Stuart England, had about double the complete fertility of the poor, 50%. So we were selecting for intelligence. I think feminism is then a later big factor because more intelligent women invest in education and so forth, don't have children, and have fewer generations, and immigration is probably a factor as well.
And I put another one. You see, it the change coincides precisely with printing and the dissemination of actual widespread literacy. I think that this is the what you need to do. I'm sure all these things that you've mentioned, these as it were, physical changes, physiological changes, play their part. But I think the key thing is this explosion in literacy, which is the function of printing, and an astonishingly widespread one. The dissemination of education, and again, the very uneven dissemination, but if you look particularly, again, you need to look across countries at very different patterns of behaviour. One of the things that's most striking is, although England is remote, it's a sort of offshore island to the continent, and especially a long way from Italy, that the impact of the Renaissance is quite peculiarly extreme in England, because the lay governing class decides to educate itself in Latin and then in Greek. They go to university. And the spectacularly high quality of our statesmanship and of our culture seems to me to be very, very closely associated with it.
Change where there is a negative association between intelligence and fertility seems to happen around about 1900. So and the peak of intelligence seems to be about 1870, based on per capita innovation, based on other measures.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a later change. What I find interesting about the 16th century in these terms is that in the you have the Black Death, and the evidence indicates that although about 40% or something like that of Europeans or English people die,
higher.
There's different estimates. It was about 80% of the serfs and free labourers. Now, that's a massive selection event. I did a paper on this. That's huge. That means that you are massively bootstrapping the population in terms of intelligence, because even then, we have studies indicating even then, the heritability across three generations of socioeconomic status was 0.75. It's 0.75 now. And that might be counterintuitive, but that's true. Clever people, Thomas Cromwell, Cardinal Wolsey, whatever, managed to make their way.
David Starkey.
Perhaps, yes, David Starkey.
The Quake is the odd business, and it's that's very odd business. I have actually looked at my family history, and for generation after generation, until we simply disappear, they are merely cotton workers. Nothing else.
Because that would have been anyway a selection event, mm-hmm. And what you would expect then is that it would take a while to... for society to reorganize itself, and there was that period of chaos, Wars of the Roses, and chaos in the way of the time of Chaucer, or whatever, then you would have a much more intelligent society, and possibly a much more religious society, because religiousness is associated with genetic health, mental health, physical health. You're selecting for these things, and then I think it's not a coincidence that then you have the Renaissance, indicating intelligence, and Reformation, indicating religiosity.
But I think none of this would have happened without printing. It seems to me that, you know, one can be a little too deterministic about these things. There have been great plagues before. They haven't had, and which presumably had exactly the effect that you described. They would have destroyed. I mean, for example, one of the greatest plagues of all has precisely the opposite effect of what you describe, which is the great plague that slashes the reign of Justinian in half, and leads pretty well directly to the fall of both the Roman and the Persian Empire and the Islamic conquest. You know? So plague then actually... What I'm gently trying to say is that using, as it were, physical determinants of culture simply by themselves, I don't think works. These are highly complex phenomena that cut across several areas. And if you think that there has been this totally revolutionary thing, why does knowledge explode from the Renaissance? It is above all that printing does, again, what is now being undone. Printing fixes knowledge. There had been lots of earlier Renaissances, that's to say, lots of earlier re-engagements with the classical world. You know, there's this preposterous myth peddled by various pop historians that we're a product of Christianity. We're not. We're a product of the revisiting of Greco-Roman culture. And there is that constant, you know, harking back to this superior civilization that lies behind us. And it had happened several times before. But the thing that fixes it, and I use that word fixing quite deliberately, is printing. Because with manuscripts, every time you copy a text, you introduce error. And we've got to get some sense of what the real intellectual foundation of this is.
You have the beginning of a cold period, in fact, it was a cold period that probably set off the Black Death. Whereas with the Justinian plague, you're in a warm period, and you've had a long warm period. And then there's a short...
So lots of lots of hot-blooded Arabs come along.
But let's move back. I mean, your printing thing, I know, let's just focus on what I wanted to focus on, which is that, for a moment, which is what interests me about this is the possibility that, yeah, we are going backwards.
I think there are many indications
that we are going backwards. Intelligence, we are going backwards. Many proxies for intelligence. We are going backwards, and other cultural forms as well.
Well, rather, we're going, all right.
It's more can we backwards.
Can we just again? Because I think it's really important. Because these are big debates going on. It's really important we clarify clearly what we're doing isn't going backwards. We're polarizing, which is exactly what is the case in the Middle Ages. There are ultra clever people in the Middle Ages. I mean, for example, you referred to that to James Dream School. One of the points I had to get home to a particularly thick boy who was absolutely convinced that because he lived in the 20th or the early 21st century, he was cleverer than Sir Thomas More, who lived in this primitive period in the past. And I gently to explain to him that his intelligence as against Thomas More's was a sort of pea against a mountain. What's going on now, I think, is a return to something like the earlier period of vast, vast gap. What happens, I think, as you go through the 17th, 18th, 19th century, is an extraordinary period of, as it were, the spread of intelligence. I look at the world, you said it went down from 1900. I look at the world of my father, a man who'd had to leave school at 11, with the most minimum of education. He lived in a world of literacy. He lived in a world of voluntary organizations, of trade unions, of numeracy, where you had to sort of collect subscriptions, of another form of numeracy with friendly societies and so on. Now, what's happened now, I think, is this process of extreme polarization. And I think there's something else that echoes the Middle Ages in a most interesting way. You are hiding an iPhone there. You have no more idea of what goes on inside that iPhone than a medieval peasant had in what he thought was a magic carpet. We operate in a world in which most everyday... When I was a boy, most men... We were too poor to have a car. Most men who were at all prosperous, they had a car, and they spent their weekends in coat overalls tinkering with that car. A car is now something that most garages can't deal with. All they do is unplug something and plug another bit in. We've moved into a world in which the ordinary is as mysterious as the miracle or transubstantiation.
Two points. One, I think, with regard to what you were saying about the lack of the opposite word of the polarization, the coming together. Yeah. I think an interesting point in that regard is that what the internet and whatever and other changes have allowed us to do is to polarize. So we are now in a world where you are of cognitive stratification, where if you are remotely intelligent, if you are, let's say, the David Starkey from Up North, then there are facilities that permit you to get out of that, and at least if you're straight, meet a girl and who's similar intelligence to you genetically and breed with her. Now, that would not have happened as easily before because you're stuck in a village somewhere or whatever, and there is less cognitive stratification, there's less facility for the intelligent working class cotton miller, whatever, to find...
What is this called? Associative
ATs? Yeah, assortative mating. Assortative mating is...
Charles Murray, is it?
Well, the idea is not from Charles Murray, but yes.
But he discussed...
William Carleton.
Yeah.
But anyway, assortative mating. And so this is permitted to... happen to a much greater extent now than was once the case. This would predict polarization. Another thing I think is probably immigration. Immigration reduces trust even among the natives because we realize.
Oh, well, now we're shifting. Now we're shifting to a different discourse. We're shifting to a political discourse, which again we need to think about rather differently because.
I really like to read the book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion by Jonathan Haidt. Apparently it does exactly what it says on the tin. It explains to you why it is that left-wing people and right-wing people have fundamentally different morality. But the thing is that I'm feeling a bit like a Generation Zer today. I just can't be bothered to read a book. If only there was some place where it could just be read to me in perhaps under 25 minutes, where the salient points could be summarised and I could just absorb the information without actually having to read. Ah, what's this? There is. There's a website called Legion.com which takes all of the based and interesting books which you'd like to read and does indeed summarise the most salient points and read them to you in under 25 minutes. And if you subscribe now with the code TJH, you can get 10% off. This means you don't have to mess about reading. You can get the based and interesting knowledge direct from your phone into your brain. So subscribe there today.
Again, you know, it is the problem when one just leaps from these broad assertions about human physiology or sexual behaviour or whatever to profound social issues. I think, as always, these things are... one of my old colleagues at Cambridge, Quentin Skinner, had this wonderful phrase, a concatenation of circumstance. It's a lot of things coming together. And I think a lot of things have come together.
Yeah.
The extraordinary shift away from, as it were, the first and second industrial revolutions, the steam industrial revolution and the straightforward electrical industrial revolution into the electronic one, and left a world in which far fewer people understand it. As I said, in which the world appears essentially miraculous.
And right. You have a situation quite interesting where the living standards can continue rising as long as our innovations are outpacing its Malthusian population growth. Our innovation.
No, Malthus said it couldn't happen, so it's not Malthus.
Oh, yes. The Malthusian. but now, so we have a situation where although intelligence is declining, the rapid rate. Is declining. Then the rapid rate at which innovation can take place based on what has already been established is overtaking that, outpacing it. And so obviously you're going to get this disconnect between the average intelligence population and the fruits of the innovative process.
But again, shouldn't one also, forgive me, we are sort of doing an absolute concertina on any serious analysis of society. The great change of the 20th century is the introduction of the welfare state. And the welfare state, I think, is the most transformative thing of all. I mean, what it does, of course, is replicate, we were talking about earlier civilizations and their collapse, and it's replicating what actually happens with Greco-Roman civilization, that what you get is you create a state apparatus which is so immensely expensive that it actually overwhelms the means of production.
You also are creating, in a sense, an incredible warm period. You are creating very, very, very weakened Darwinian conditions.
No, I understand that. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, you could argue at the moment that, in fact, if you look, shall we be utterly blunt? If you look at breeding patterns, on the whole, the best able to breed produce the fewest children, and those least able produce the most. To put it, as I'm famous for putting things bluntly and saying things that can't be said, isn't that what's going on?
Exactly. If you look at Adam Perkins' book, The Welfare Trade, if you divide between a couple where both parents are working, IQ probably 100 on average, a couple where one parent's on welfare, IQ let's say 90, a couple where both parents on welfare, IQ let's say 85, and a couple where both parents on welfare and there has to be police and social worker interventions, the criminal underclass among the whites, only that group has above replacement fertility. So that, and the heritability of intelligence is about 0.8, the heritability of character, personality, whatever, is about 0.6. So the result is these people are the future. On the other hand, among the more...
Well, I really think, Ed, it's very important you restate that, because there is this myth, there is this omnipresent myth, the myth of the left, A, that we're all the same, and B, that there is no such thing as an innate difference of intelligence, that intelligence is not due to heredity, but it is due merely to circumstances. What you're saying is, and please repeat it and do those figures again more slowly, this is absolutely untrue, and it's demonstrably untrue.
Demonstrably untrue. Chats, well, I think most of my viewers will know that. We have twin adoption studies, and we have now polygenic score studies, and we know the heritability of intelligence among adults is 0.8. It's extremely high. And it's probably becoming higher due to increasing assortative mating. In India, where there's massive assortative mating, the heritability of intelligence is 0.9.
So, but on the other hand, the behavior of American Ivy League students would suggest that high intelligence and certain forms of stupidity, by the way, do also go.
Well, that's interesting, because there is a correlation of about 0.3 between intelligence and social conformity. So people that are intelligence is about surviving in Parsi. And so they look around the world, they notice, like the Marquess of Winchester. Let's go back to the Tudor thing. The Marquess of Winchester, William Paulet, the only person that was in government under Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, and he said he was like a willow. He's Protestant when they're Protestant, he's Catholic when they're Catholic, and he's Church of England when they're...
Everybody was. Everybody apart from a handful of martyrs. Now, what you've got, the peculiar, right, everybody, this is a really interesting point. If, again, we're looking at the greatness of that age, you're looking at somebody like Shakespeare, all the literary scholars go on about, oh, isn't it extraordinary with Shakespeare? His grandfather was a Roman Catholic. Everybody's grandfather had been a Roman Catholic. No, but it's really, but everybody was a vicar of Bray. Even Mary, when Mary runs out of martyrs by the end of her reign, and she's only burned about 600. You run out because most people, not surprisingly, bearing in mind the utter horror. I mean, being burned in Spain is one thing, in whatever number it is, a dry climate and with dry wood. Being burned in England is slow barbecuing, went on for hours. Very few people are prepared to put themselves through that. So, again, one of the extraordinary things about 16th century England is universal apostasy, repeated apostasy.
So they're all socially conformist, intelligent people. They look around the world, they realise what the dominant set of worldview is, they imbibe it, and then they competitively signal.
But then of course, on the other hand, intelligence, super high intelligence, is also associated with a high degree of being a heretic.
Yeah, we
need to make that distinction.
That's the nuance, yes. There is that relationship, but then you find that the people that outlier high intelligence, and you see this particularly among geniuses, particularly if they combine outlier high intelligence with subclinical psychopathy, autistic traits, whatever, then they like offending, they like stirring it up.
Adore it, in fact.
It's what gets out of bed in the morning. That's why David was early to this interview.
Do you know what one of my recreations in Who's Who is? Treading on toes.
Oh, yeah. So I keep sort of skimming over this issue, but I really want to look at this. What I would augur is that we would be moving back in some respects. Is this the polarization to the time, basically, that is your area, that's your big thing, which is the time of Henry VIII. And I wonder, or around that time, maybe a bit later.
Earlier, right. Earlier, I suspect. Earlier. I mean, I think I hope you're wrong. Let's go back to one thing you said about me, which I feel is very flattering, and I hope I do it. I try to talk to everybody in the same way, because I actually believe that even with all of the things you're saying, providing you actually understand what you're saying yourself, you talk clearly and you talk honestly and you talk at a level, people can understand, that the average can understand. You're talking about essentially, I think, a lumpen, what used fashionably in Marxist analysis to be called a lumpen proletariat. And they are at the very edge of society, they always have been. There was an extraordinary effort, for example, in late Victorian England to deal with that. There was an effort of moral reform. There were social pressures. There was a rigorous reconstruction of welfare. Again, it's very striking looking at the idiocies that we've lapsed ourselves into with very intelligent people running welfare. Victorian welfare had a simple, very simple principle. It's called less eligibility, that nobody on welfare should receive more than the lowest wage that anybody in work was paid. And we could solve all those problems of welfare if we simply went back to that rule. Because one of the other things you haven't talked about, which I think is more interesting, dare I say, than these, is feminization. It is the all of the things that you and I have been disapproving of is the substitution of feminine virtues for masculine ones. Sympathy, empathy, looking after the underdog, you know, all of those kind of things. And that seems to me as pure sentimentality. The thing that most drives me mad now about public discourse is his absolute sloppy-minded sentimentality, and that's catastrophic. And Christianity, I'm afraid, has got a very great deal to answer for. In earlier periods, Christianity, I think, was very much kept under control by the classical past, the importance of classical education. I mean, the very fact that the upper classes, right from that point onwards, saw themselves effectively draped in togas and reenacting the role.
Yes, this is good. I mean, I've looked at this a lot in my own research, but yeah, you're familiar with Jonathan Haidt's five moral foundations, this idea that there are, because we are pack animals, there's the group-oriented foundations of in-group loyalty, obedience to authority, and sanctity, which tends to sanctify that, which is good for the group, and taboo that, which is disgust, that's bad for them. And then the individually oriented foundations of equality and harm avoidance. And if you are at the bottom of the group, then it makes sense to militate, to push in favour of equality, because then you get more. It's a selfish thing. You get more, and harm avoidance, because then you are harmed less. And of course, if you are of low status,
hence Nietzsche's description of Christianity as a religion of slaves.
Right, and that's where it started. So where it started, Christianity was basically middle, wasn't working class, it was middle class people, business owners that had fishing industries, whatever. That would virtue signal those qualities. And that appeals to the right, because the right is high in all five of these foundations, but the left is only high in two, equality and harm avoidance. So things will always move leftwards until they become so dysphoric, until so many people feel their needs in terms of structure and all are not met, or there's a backlash, a war, a plague, AIDS. AIDS backlash, huge backlash against homosexuality.
No, it wasn't. That's absolutely nonsense. I am gay, and I live with percentages of people
who were interviewed in the 70s and 80s and thought homosexuality was unacceptable.
But actually, you know, in Britain, that's what people may have said. What is very striking in Britain, it really is very important we say this, Thatcher herself, and particularly Norman Fowler, as Secretary of State for Health, the campaign, talking about the danger of AIDS, presented it as a danger. It lied. It presented it as a danger to everybody. It was quite spectacularly not homophobic. And I think this is something we really do need to understand. And again, public attitudes were markedly softening from the 50s onwards. And curiously, I think that in some ways, AIDS, because of feminization and that sense of feeling tender, actually helped. You had the extraordinary behavior of Princess Diana. There is the obituary today. I've now forgotten her name, but the highly distinguished Christian doctor who set up at the Mile May Hospital in the East End of London as the first proper hospice and whatever. I don't think there's any accident. For example, the equalization of the age of consent, I know because I played a large part in getting it, or the beginnings of it. It was 91. It takes place immediately after. The campaign begins in 1990 and it culminates after Major replaces Margaret Thatcher.
Right, so
AIDS was by no means under control at that point. We were pushing at a very open door. I think one's got to be very careful about. You seem to me it's all really interesting, but it's terribly schematic. What I'm trying to say is, again, invoking my old chum Quentin Skinner, I'm sure it's slightly shudder at being called my chum, indeed anybody's chum, but it is concatenation of circumstance. And societies are immensely complex things. They don't just respond to one set of variables.
But I think that in science, that's the difference about, from my perspective and yours, I consider it a positive to try
to try, and I know you can say it's simplifying it, but to engage in a reasonable level of reductions. And you can say that anything is a concatenation of circumstances, anything is a mixture of circumstances, and it's dreadfully complicated and it's difficult to understand. And
I haven't said that. No.
A lot of circumstances, a lot of things have to be unpicked and all this sort of
stuff. So human beings are not susceptible to Occam's razor. And you're playing a very crude, right, let me come back. You're being a Sweeney Todd of the mind, and it won't do. You're slashing. That what one's got to do, and I'm not arguing for not understanding. I'm quite good at understanding. I think my books are pretty clear, and they've enormously advanced knowledge. And they advance knowledge by the weighing of different factors, of trying to understand how they interplay. What you're saying seems to me to be extraordinarily valuable. I'm fascinated by it. It's why I'm engaged in discourse with you. But I think it... And also you're playing a terrible game, Ed. You're playing into the hands of the left. The left believe that human society is subject to the sciences. That's why there is this deadly thing called the political or the social sciences. They believe that we are mere automata who respond, you know, to one factor or another factor. And I'm sorry, I believe in humanity. I believe that we're not quite as simple as that. I am not. I mean, so much of what you've been saying is a modern version of utilitarianism. We've had another version of utilitarianism from one of my colleagues at LSE today, bravely explaining how money is spent on improving mental health, you know, and getting people back into work automatically recoups its cost. But as far as I'm aware, nobody has ever proved that state intervention in that area works at all. You see what I mean? I think that
the difference is that those on the left would opine that there is a degree to which humans are some sort of blank slate that will respond to environmental I am suggesting that humans are an advanced form of ape, and that therefore how they will behave can be to a significant degree reduced down to that, and we can take something like
isn't this crass Darwinianism?
Well, if you're going to use the word crass, that's just basically an appeal to insult, and it implies...
No. What he's just saying is you will remember when Disraeli gave his speech at Oxford, I am on the side of the angels. I believe that we are more than merely an ape, that human consciousness is something different. I think that human memory and collective memory is something different. I don't think societies are simply mechanistic. I refuse either to be bullied or blinded with science. No. But again, this is both a discussion and an interview. I'm just wanting to, again, like Disraeli, to say, finally, I'm on the side of the angels. I think that there is something different. There is something that is beyond the merely animal.
Even that phrase, I'm on the side of the angels, is manipulative.
Of course.
And it brings us this.
It's called rhetoric.
Exactly. Are you ready for the future of the West?